So let's just say that on March 21, 2011, the University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana accepted James Egan Holmes into its graduate program in neuroscience. The school offered him a $22,660 annual stipend and waived his tuition and fees as long as he maintained appropriate academic success. Those who met you during your interview felt that your personal and professional qualities are truly outstanding and that you will be an excellent match for our program. That was the Illinois University acceptance letter from Professor J. Lee Beverly. He was, by all accounts, a remarkable student, gifted. The letters from professors previous to his acceptance at the University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana indicated a remarkable and gifted scholar. As you perhaps know, James Holmes ultimately rejected the offer from Champaign-Urbana to attend the University of Colorado, Denver. He dropped out of that program in early June, and he's been charged with 142 counts in connection with the July 20 attack during the Dark Knight Rises. Columbine, April 20, 1999, 12 students and one teacher killed. Aurora, Colorado, 2012, who's next and where? And how do we account for and explain these events? Chalk it up to mentally ill folks who are also heavily armed and out for blood? Are our gun laws to blame? How do we explain these incidents? Is some principle of evil, a force promoting hatred and violence, lurking somewhere within each one of us, just waiting for a catalyst to release it? It's not just Unitarian Universalists who aren't especially comfortable with talking about notions of evil these days. I don't think you find many religionists who are especially comfortable talking about abiding evil lurking in the human soul. Even those folks who turn to the devil as an explanation for violence view the devil or Satan as an external force, a malign force operating in the world. The reactions of the folks following the carnage in Aurora was detailed in a long feature article in the Denver Post on Sunday, August 12, exploring what we might call the theology of the shooting. The people who were quoted come from a variety of different religious traditions. The comments of shooting victim Pierce O'Farrell, who attends a Baptist church, is not atypical. He said he perceived the mass murderer's entrance into the theater as an evil presence, but then God arrived, he said, and the gunman stopped shooting at people. God jammed his gun, many have since asserted. It's just true that people of faith seldom lose their faith because of horrible events. In desperate times, it seems that people turn to their faith tradition or another faith tradition with even more passion and intensity. We're not asking God why he did or didn't do this or that on that night. That's Tom Sullivan, father of Alex Sullivan, who died from a gunshot wound to the head that night. It was his 27th birthday. We're thanking God for the gift we have in Alex. You have to enjoy every day of your life. I'm not bitter. We hear this again and again. I don't know why some were lost and some were spared. I don't know that. That's Michael Walker, senior pastor at Church in the City, whose congregation includes some moviegoers who were injured that fateful night. God's ways are not my ways, Walker said, but for those who know him and have a relationship with him, they have an eternal future. We have hope in a God who will help us get through. God's people shine brightest in the darkness of evil. From these quotes and others, we might conclude that there is nothing that can happen in this world that would challenge this absolute faith in God. Is this good, though? Are we telling the truth? Isn't that important too, being honest, thinking critically and carefully? Suppose something makes my heart feel good, but leaves my brain deeply dissatisfied. Joseph Conrad's novella, Heart of Darkness, has been judged by many modern critics to be one of the finest works of the Western canon. It's especially impressive because Conrad's first language was Polish, not English. He learned English later in his life, but became a genius in his writing. And Heart of Darkness, though not long, is powerful. It keeps being discovered generation after generation. First published in 1899, it awakes new readers to its power. The story centers on Charlie Marlowe. He narrates most of the short book. He's an Englishman. He's taken an assignment from a Belgian trading company as a riverboat captain in Africa. That echoes precisely what Joseph Conrad did. Conrad worked as a riverboat captain in the Belgian Congo. When Vicky shows her film tonight about the Kinshasa Symphony, we fast forward to another moment in the history of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Heart of Darkness exposes the dark side of European colonization while exploring three levels of darkness: the darkness of the Congo jungle, the darkness of the Europeans' treatment of indigenous African peoples, and the darkness within every human being. Conrad didn't give the name of the river at the time of the writing. The Congo Free State, the location of the large and important Congo River, was a prize colony in the possession of Belgium's King Leopold II. In the story, Marlowe is hired to transport ivory, but he has another and important calling. He's also to retrieve Kurtz, who is another ivory trader gone rogue, maybe gone mad, and bring him back to civilization. If you remember Francis Ford Coppola's movie Apocalypse Now, set in Vietnam and Cambodia, Martin Sheen's character, Captain Benjamin Willard, stands for Marlowe, while Marlon Brando's Colonel Walter E. Kurtz represents Conrad's Kurtz. But in the movie, Captain Willard kills Colonel Kurtz. In Heart of Darkness, their relationship is gentler, though Marlowe is certainly troubled by the ways Kurtz has descended into megalomania and violence. Knowing that Kurtz was a humanitarian and, by all accounts, a brilliant person, Marlowe transports Kurtz, now ill and dying, back to civilization via the riverboat Marlowe captains. Marlowe becomes familiar with Kurtz's writings, wherein he once penned, "We whites must necessarily appear to Africans in the nature of supernatural beings. By the simple exercise of our will, we can exert a power for good practically unbounded. Each transfer station should be like a beacon on the road toward better things, a center for trade, of course, but also for humanizing, improving, instructing." His views change, however, from this paternalistic colonialism to these final thoughts: exterminate the brutes. Now near death, Kurtz gives Marlowe a collection of papers and a photograph for safekeeping. The photograph is of a beautiful young woman who Marlowe correctly assumes is Kurtz's fiancée, or as Marlowe calls her, his intended, Kurtz's intended. The dying words that Kurtz utters and that Marlowe hears are among the most famous in English literature. What does Kurtz see in those last seconds of his life that cause him to say, "The horror, the horror"? Neither Marlowe nor the reader know for sure. Marlowe returns to Europe and visits Kurtz's fiancée with his packet of material. She's still in mourning, and she strongly maintains naive notions of Kurtz's virtue. When she asks about Kurt's death and his final words, Marlowe faces a terrible conundrum. Like great works of literature, there is a lot more to Heart of Darkness than this brief plot summary. In fact, it's the complexity of this very short work that gives it its power, and then the beauty of the writing. For our purposes, let me say that most modern interpretations see Marlowe as the primary character and not Kurtz. Marlowe, participant, narrator, teller of the tale, and as the last person to have seen Kurtz alive, the only witness Kurtz's fiancée has to rely upon to hear of his life in Africa and his life's ending. The climax of the novella and of Marlowe's narration center around the meeting between Marlowe and Kurtz's fiancée, never named, only identified with the title The Intended. It's brilliantly composed by Conrad, for it is truly a confrontation between what Marlowe has seen and what Kurt's fiancé believes. Earlier, Marlowe identified himself this way. You know, I hate, detest, and can't bear a lie. Not because I am straighter than the rest of us, but simply because it appalls me. There is a taint of death, a flavor of mortality in lies, which is exactly what I hate and detest in the world, what I want to forget. It makes me miserable and sick, like biting something rotten would do. I rang the bell before a mahogany door on the first floor, and while I waited, Kurtz seemed to stare at me out of the glassy panel. I seemed to hear the whispered cry, the horror, the horror. A high door opened, closed, I rose, she came forward all in black, with a pale head floating toward me in the dusk. She was in mourning. It was more than a year since his death, more than a year since the news came. So what would you do? What would you do in Aurora, Colorado, if you were to talk to a survivor? What will you say about God, about the meaning of life, about death and destruction that comes in a second and robs you of the people you loved when you thought all they were doing was going to a theater performance? What do you say when somebody dies on the street in an accident? What are you called upon to do to honestly represent the truth? Because the brain must be satisfied with the truth. This is precisely what Marlowe confronts, and it's why Conrad viewed the conclusion of Heart of Darkness as the most significant part of this story. The meeting between Marlowe and the fiancé. I laid the packet gently on the little table, and she put her hand over it. You knew him well. Intimacy grows quickly out there, I said. I knew him as well as it's possible for one man to know another. And you admired him, she said. It was impossible to know him and not to admire him. Was it? He was a remarkable man, I said, unsteadily. Remarkable man in that he organized native peoples to view him as a god. And he organized brutal raids upon other villages and other ivory traders. And in the community Kurtz inhabited, there were the skulls of the people that he had killed. You were his friend, she went on, his friend. You must have been, if he has given you this and sent you to me. Who was not his friend who had heard him speak once, she was saying. He drew men toward him by what was best in them. She looked at me with intensity. It is the gift of the great. And the sound of her low voice seemed to have the accompaniment of all the other sounds, full of mystery, desolation, and sorrow. All the sounds I had ever heard, the ripple of the river, The soughing of the trees swayed by the wind, the murmurs of the crowds, the faint ring of incomprehensible words cried from afar, the whisper of a voice speaking from beyond the threshold of an eternal darkness. "But you have heard him, you know," she cried. "Yes, I know," I said with something like despair in my heart, but bowing my head before the faith that was in her, before that great and saving illusion that shone with an unearthly glow in the darkness, in the triumphant darkness from which I could not have defended her, from which I could not even defend myself. What a loss to me, to us, to the world. All of his promise, all of his greatness, all of his generous mind and his noble heart, nothing remains, nothing but a memory. "We shall always remember him," I said hastily. Very suddenly, she said, "He died as he lived." "His end," I said, with dull anger stirring in me, "was in every way worthy of his life." "And I was not with him," she murmured. "My anger," Marlowe says, "my anger subsided before a feeling of infinite pity." "You were with him to the last. I think of his loneliness, nobody near to understand him as I would have understood." "To the very end," I said shakily, "I heard his last words." I stopped in a fright, Marlowe says, because he knows he's said too much now. "Repeat them," she murmured in a heartbroken tone. I want something to live with." I was on the point of crying out at her, "Don't you hear them?" The dusk was repeating them in a persistent whisper all around us, in a whisper that seemed to swell menacing like the first whisper of a rising wind. "The horror, the horror." "His last word, to live with," she insisted. "Don't you understand? I loved him. I loved him. I loved him." I pulled myself together and spoke slowly. "The last word he pronounced was your name." Critics of earlier times saw in this ending a failure on Conrad's part. Allowing Marlowe to lie seemed to them a betrayal of the story's meaning. Later critics see in this ending Conrad's genius. It is a lie. A lie. So what would you do you think? Because it is important to tell the truth. I mean, that's one of our principles, to search for the truth, to tell the truth, to be honest about it. It's not that Kurt's fiancée does not deserve to hear the truth. Rather, she deserves not to hear the truth. I know this sounds perhaps like terrible philosophy and poor psychology. Perhaps it doesn't even sound like good religion. But I believe in Marlowe's pity, in his compassion, and in his lie. The most famous words in Heart of Darkness are Kurtz's last, "The horror, the horror." And these are the very words Marlowe cannot bring himself to repeat. And so, frankly, he betrays himself. He betrays truth. He protects an illusion. He commits fraud or perjury. And it costs him. We see that in the way the story ends. What do you think you might do? Ultimately, we can only speak our truth, that which convinces us and compels us. But I accept that sometimes our deepest truth must also be our greatest lie.